crowds of mourners attending a funeral ceremony in the Iranian capital for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated on Sunday. Household energy bills in Britain are set to surge by another 40% in October, deepening a cost-of-living crisis on average Britons. Also in the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson facing renewed accusations of lying after new photos emerge of him taking part at a party during the 2020 COVID lockdown. Welcome. Now, starting this news hour in the Iranian capital city, Tehran, where earlier today a funeral procession was held for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, who was assassinated on Sunday. Hundreds of mourners attended the event, many of them holding pictures of Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai, chanting slogans against the U.S. and Israel. Khodai was assassinated in his car just outside his home in an eastern Tehran neighborhood. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. The IRGC has called his killing an act of terrorism. Top Commander Major General Hossein Salami has pledged to avenge Khodai's assassination, said that the response will be tough and will make the enemies regret the heinous crime. Now to Iran's southwestern city of Abadan, where rescuers are combing through the rubble of a collapsed building for survivors. At least 11 people are confirmed dead, and there are fears the number of casualties could rise, with reports saying that up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. That the three people have already been pulled from the 10-story building that came down on Monday. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road. The surrounding buildings have all been evacuated. Provincial governor saying that based on initial technical assessments, questionable construction practices are the leading cause of the tragedy. 10 people, including the mayor and several people involved in the construction of a major trade center, are in detention. The owner is said to have lost his life in the incident. Now let's listen to comments by President of Iranian Red Crescent Society about the ongoing rescue operations at the site.
Rescue teams are working to their fullest potential. Operations are in progress at a higher speed thanks to the deployment of more and better equipment to the area. We are trying to access the underground level to save those trapped there. All buildings in the vicinity of the collapsed structure have been evacuated to protect residents from potential risks.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has made a one-day visit to Oman on his fifth official foreign trip. The two sides discussed bilateral issues and signed a string of trade deals. The visit is said to have been in line with the Iran administration's policy of boosting cooperation with regional states.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ibrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament to, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman.
Since taking office in August, President Raisi has stressed the need for a stronger trade and economic collaboration with Arab countries in the Persian Gulf. Now, his administration has already struck major agreements with Qatar, while trade delegates have been dispatched to UAE and Oman in recent months to explore enhanced economic ties. Meantime, Tehran has emphasized that regional states are capable of solving their problems by relying on their own resources and without foreign military or political intervention.
An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy, and part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
Moving on, Iranian Foreign Ministry says that the U.S. has opened support for Tel Aviv has further emboldened the occupying regime. The ministry's spokesman, Said Khatibzadeh, says this has been worsened by international indifference to the regime's repeated acts of aggression against Syria. He condemned Israel's recent missile strikes on Damascus, saying that the regime's military is serving the air force of terrorist groups operating in Syria. Khatibzadeh says that Israel launches attacks whenever the Syrian army scores a victory against terror outfits. The spokesman also underlined the need for a strong response to Israel's acts of aggression, both on the battlefield and at the international level. On Friday, Israel launched a large-scale missile attack on Damascus, killing three people and razing buildings near a key mosque in the city. Now, taking a look at Europe, Britain's facing another jump in their power and energy bills, deepening the worst cost-of-living crisis the UK has seen since the 1950s. The Office of Energy Regulations, the UK, warning of a 40% surge in household energy bills in October. Ofgem Chief Jonathan Barrley calls the price rise a, quote, once-in-a-generation event not seen since the oil crisis in the 1970s. He says the number of people in fuel poverty may double to 12 million. A household is in fuel poverty when it has to spend 10% or more of its disposable income on energy. The opposition Labour Party is saying that this will cause enormous worry for families already facing soaring bills. Conditions at the global gas market have worsened since Russia launched a war in Ukraine, and the West targeted the Russian energy sector with sanctions. Also in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson facing new accusations of lying after photos emerge of him at a Downing Street party during the 2020 COVID lockdown. The photos obtained by ITV show Johnson raising a glass at a party with bottles of alcohol and food lying on the table. They also show eight people standing closer together. The party was held at a time when only two people from different households were allowed to mix indoors. Outside gathering was banned completely due to soaring COVID cases. The photos cast a fresh doubt about a prime minister's claims that he was unaware of rule-breaking parties at Downing Street. Johnson told lawmakers in December 2021 that all guidelines were followed in his office. But later he apologized after a video emerged showing his senior aide joking about holding a Christmas party during the lockdown. Russia and Ukrainian forces are engaged in the heaviest fighting in eastern Ukraine as the war between the two neighbors grinds through its third month. According to Ukrainian authorities, Russia keeps bombing the twin cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in an attempt to control the Donbas region. The Ukrainian foreign minister has described the fighting as the largest battle on European soil since the Second World War. Russia says its forces have hit an arms depot in Donbas where mortar shells for U.S.-made howitzers were stored. The Russian defense minister, however, says Moscow is deliberately slowing its offensive to allow civilians to evacuate.
Ceasefires are being declared and humanitarian corridors created in order to get people out of settlements that are surrounded. Of course, this slows down the pace of the offensive, but this is done deliberately to avoid casualties among the civilian population.
Meantime, the Kremlin expressed hope to receive an Italian peace plan through diplomatic channels. Rome has presented a four-point plan to the UN Secretary General. According to Italian media, the first step in the plan is a ceasefire to allow civilian evacuations and demilitarization of the front lines. The initiative also calls for a bilateral agreement between Russia and Ukraine on the future of Crimea and Donbas. It also seeks a peace agreement between the European Union and Russia. Jana Miller reports from the Donbas region to find people who no longer wish to be part of Ukraine.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbas People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartments 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So, in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theater. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Liberation of Khorramshahr, Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. May 24th is the Day of Liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr, in the southwest of Iran. It took place in 1982 during the eight-year war that the United States and its accomplices had imposed on Iran through their stooge in the region, Saddam of the Ba'ath regime. The day has been named as the Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory in the Islamic Republic of Iran calendar. Stay tuned for a special feature on this occasion. The history of Iran's holy defense against the Ba'athist 8-year invasion was full of great days whose glory has remained indelibly in the minds of the Iranian nation. However, May 24th is among the greatest and brightest days of the holy defense, as it was a turning point in the war and changed the equations of the war against the initiator of the war and his Western and Eastern masters and regional supporters. Khorramshahr is a strategic port in Khuzestan province, southwest of Iran. It is located on the confluence of the two rivers, Karun and Arvand. The city was occupied by Saddam's army on October 26, 1980, after 35 exemplary resistance of young Iranian combatants and ordinary people of the city. Khorramshahr was liberated after 578 days on May 24, 1982, in an honorable operation. The operation was carried out jointly by the Iranian army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC. The liberation of Khorramshahr was the most important phase of Beit al-Muqaddas, which included four phases. The stiff battle terminated 19 months of the occupation of the strategic port and dealt a very deadly blow to the war machine of Saddam and the morale of Iraqi invading forces. The liberation of Khorramshahr was considered as a prelude to the fall of Basra. As a matter of fact, the Iraqi dictator Saddam had arrogantly said, "If Iranians retake Khorramshahr, I will give them the key to Basra." However, the Iranian brave combatants smashed the Iraqi fortifications and positions just to astound military experts in the world. Nearly 16,000 enemy forces were killed and injured. More than 19,000 others were taken captive by the Iranian forces. After liberation of the strategic port city of Khorramshahr, the Iranian youth performed prayer at the main mosque of the city known as Masjid-e-Jame. The news of this great victory was soon spread across Iran and made the whole nation happy. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued a message in part of which he said, "I am thankful for the telegraphs sent to me on the liberation of Khorramshahr. Unlimited gratitude should be expressed to Almighty God, who has helped and supported the Islamic country and devoted and selfless combatants and granted us his great victory." Elsewhere in his message, the Imam said, "It is God who liberated Khorramshahr." Imam Khomeini, in fact, meant to teach a lesson to the Iranian combatants and nation not to fall in the vanity to think that they had gained victory without God's help. Anyway, the liberation of Khorramshahr taught Saddam and his Western and Eastern masters and his supporters among the reactionary Arab regimes not to think of another invasion of the Iranian territory and values. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the liberation of Khorramshahr, "When our armed forces started their move with prudence, sharp-sightedness, willpower stemming from faith, trust in God, using all facilities so that they didn't let the least thing be wasted, and relying on their power and trusting in Almighty God, no one in the world believed that they could liberate Khorramshahr, but they succeeded. When we announced that we had retaken Khorramshahr, The news agencies of the world were not intent to release the news looking at it doubtfully, but this occurred, and in the end, everyone was forced to admit this victory. The city of Khorramshahr was liberated, and it turned into the unforgettable memory of unity, resistance, and victory of the Iranian nation. It is a lesson to mankind that God supports and helps the oppressed and those who have been kept weak and inferior. It has inspired hope among poor nations to stand against tyranny and oppression till ultimate victory.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Today, brothers and sisters, inshallah, we're going to be addressing a very, very important spiritual disease. So, the disease you and I are going to talk about is one which is called in Arabic su'udhan. It's when we think badly of others. One of the ahadith about su'udham, it's interesting how serious this is. Listen to this one. It's from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Prophet says this: Inna Allah ta'ala, truly Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, harrama min al muslim, has made three things forbidden in regard to a believer. One of them, damahu, the blood of a mu'min. Not allowed to kill a mu'min, take somebody's life, damahu. Wa malahu, we're not allowed to steal from a believer, reach into somebody's pocket, right? And these are all ugly, ugly sins. But then look at this one. Wa an yadhunna bihi dhanna saw, that the person think badly of a Muslim. Three things Allah has forbidden. One of them is for us to think badly of another Muslim. This hadith I'm going to share is also from the Prophet, but this one, I want you to keep it in your minds for later when we talk about the cure. Because it's a deeper dive, we're not going to rush through this. Because some of these hadith, we literally have to take time, look at them, think about them. How does this apply? What are scenarios? So that we can rid ourselves of this trait. But right now, I want you to think about it, because later on with the cure, this is going to be important. Our Prophet says this, Iyakum wadhan. Beware of thinking badly of others. فَإِنَّ الذَّنَّ أَكْذَبُ الْكَذِبُ. Truly, thinking badly of others is the biggest lie. It's the biggest lie. How is this a lie? Think about this, right? In my heart of hearts, I've seen suffering from this brother or this sister. Now, without hujjah, I think differently, but I haven't even changed my behavior towards them. Or I have, God forbid, in the first one. Now I'm not as kind, not as friendly. I have changed my behavior. Why is that a lie? I haven't said anything to anybody. What some scholars tell us is this is the possible explanation. This is part for the cure later on. I'm making a judgment based on my waham, based on my imagination. I don't have hujjah. I don't have Islamic proof. But I've come to a conclusion. In my mind, I'm lying to myself. I've told myself, this person, they didn't pass salams to me. This person ignored me, right? Somebody walked. I said salam. They didn't say salam back. I assume they did it out of arrogance. I told myself in my mind, See how arrogant that brother or sister is? They don't even return salams. I lied to myself. I didn't have hujjah. I'm talking to myself. Now, what happens is, and we'll talk about this more later, but the hadith, the second one from Amir al-Mu'mineen, tells us that this destroys ibadah. Let's say there's a believer for the month of Ramadan. I've been careful, avoiding haram, doing much ibadah, great ibadah. I've stayed up on the nights of Qadr. What can ruin my ibadah? Imam Ali says. He says, Iyaka an tasi'a dhan. Beware of thinking badly of anyone. فَإِنَّ الذَّنْ If you think badly of someone, يُفْسِدُ الْعِبَادَةِ That worship that you're waiting for on the last day, this is going to count. It's going to be in my hasanah. يُفْسِدُ الْعِبَادَةِ It destroys it. وَيُعْذِمُ الْوِزْرِ I had sins. Everybody sometimes might have some sins. There's some things we can do that intensify sin. One of them is thinking badly of others. It makes the sin much greater than it is. What's the opposite of this? The opposite of this is the trait that we all want to have when we're dealing with other believers. And it's the opposite. Whenever someone does or says anything, and there's a possibility, I don't have hujjah, there's a possibility of there being a good reason for this, or even, I'm going to explain, sometimes bad behavior, that there's two ways of interpreting this. Either I can interpret it in the worst way, or I can say, no, maybe there's an excuse. The husnul dhan is when I always am positive about other believers. I'll give you, first read the hadith together. So Imam Ali says this, Dha amra akhika ala ahsani. If there's something that your brother does, there's two ways of interpreting it, multiple ways of interpreting it. He says, make sure that you assume the best, ahsana. Hatta ya'tiyaka ma yaghlibuka min. Until you receive that hujjah, that proof that no, this is something, it's unjustifiable. There's no way, this is wrong. What just happened was wrong. There's no, then I can. He says, وَلَا تَظُنَّنَّ بِكَلِمَةٍ خَرَجَتْ مِنْ أَخِيكَ سُوءًا. Your brother says something, texts something, calls, I hear something. Never think badly of what was said. وَأَنْتَ تَجِدُ لَهَا فِي الْخَيْرِ مَحْمِلًا. But there is a way that this wasn't as bad as I thought it could be. Right? So there's sometimes when there's no explanation, Imam Ali is not telling us that. This is haram. This is wrong action. It's okay. No, no, no. That's right? But there's two ways when somebody does something. Maybe I can assume the person did it on accident. They weren't intending that. Sometimes I tell people, even when you're texting, right? With texts, because they're not, you're not seeing the person, you don't see their expression, right? It's a lot colder. Right? I don't know the context that's necessarily there. Maybe the person, right? I could assume good or I could assume bad. We assume good. There's another time when even somebody does a mistake. This is what some scholars have mentioned. I'm with a family member and actually they do make a mistake. Let's say they raise their voice with me. Shout. For some reason, we got into an argument. There's one time when I assume the worst. The reason you raised your voice with me is that you think so little of me. That's one interpretation. There's another time when I say, well, maybe they're tired. Maybe they're, right? It's still wrong. I'm not justifying their action, but I don't assume that this was out of spite. You're trying to hurt me. That's one time, one take. No, inshallah. Right? So what happens is, of course, there's no excuse for misbehaving. And none of us can use this as an excuse that I'm mistreating you. And then I'm like, you have to find a good way of understanding. No, astaghfirullah. That's, we're trying to fix ourselves. Right? So when other people do this, we want to try. The imam says this, اطلب لأخيك عذرا. Try and find some excuse for your Muslim brother. He says, فَإِنْ لَمْ تَجِدْ لَهُ عُذْرًا If you can't find an excuse, فَلْتَمِسْ لَهُ عُذْرًا Try, maybe there's some way that I don't have to come to that conclusion that this person is wicked and evil and trying to get me, trying to hurt me. If we can do that, brothers and sisters, the hadith tell us that this leads to us having a lot less stress. These people have husnul dhan towards others, a lot less stress in their lives. I don't have to assume, always feel everybody's against me, everybody's plotting, everybody's thinking, what are they doing, why? The hadith says this, husnuddhan rahatul qalb. The person who always thinks good of others, when something happens, oh no, inshallah. That person there, their heart's at peace. It also, later on when we look at the hadith, a lot of sins happening because of this. Let's say there's a family, and I'm suspicious of either of my spouse. Suspicious of my spouse. Or suspicious of another. There's many sins that this can lead to. One of them is the sin of spying. Whereas the Quran says, لا تجسسوا, don't spy. In order for me to fix, to find out, we're going to talk about this later. In order for me to find out, yes or no, maybe they weren't thinking bad, I start to spy. What is that? What happens with that? We'll talk about that later. Right? But it's the mother of many sins. Imam Ali again, he says, حُسْنُ الظَّنِ يُخَفِّفُ الْهَمِّ. It keeps us from worrying. It lessens our worry. I expect good from God, good from people. People want to do the right thing. They have a fitrah. The Imam says it gives me less worry. وَيُنَجِّي مِن تَقَلُّدِ الْإِثْمِ. It keeps me from committing many of the sins that other people might commit.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. Experts say COVID-19 has seriously exacerbated problems such as anxiety, depression and self-harm among school children in England, and that the relentless and unsustainable ongoing rise in their need for help could overwhelm the National Health Service. We are prepared through an article written by Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled Record 420,000 Children a Month in England Treated for Mental Health Problems. In England, more than 400,000 children and young people a month are being treated for mental health problems, the highest number on record, prompting warnings of an unprecedented crisis in the well-being of under-18s. Experts say COVID-19 has seriously exacerbated problems such as anxiety, depression, and self-harm among school-age children, and that the relentless and unsustainable ongoing rise in their need for help could overwhelm the National Health Service. The latest NHS figures show open referrals, troubled children and young people in England undergoing treatment or waiting to start care, reached 420,314 in February, the highest number since records began in 2016. The total has risen by 147,853 since February of 2020, a 54% increase, and by 80,096 over the last year alone, a jump of 24%. January's tally of 411,132 cases was the first time the figure had topped 400,000. Mental health charities welcomed the UK officials' claim that an all-time high number of young people are receiving psychological support. But they fear the figures are the tip of an iceberg of the true number of people who need care, and that many more under-18s in distress are being denied help by arbitrary eligibility criteria. Open referrals are under-18s who are being cared for by child and adolescent mental health services, or are waiting to see a specialist, having been assessed as needing help against treatment thresholds. General practitioners, GPs, teachers and mental health charities believe the criteria are too strict, exclude many who are deemed not ill enough, and amount to rationing of care. Ollie Parker, the head of external affairs at the charity Young Minds, said, "There is an unprecedented crisis in young people's mental health, further evidenced by these record numbers of young people needing help from the National Health Service." Ollie Parker added, "The record high number of children and young people receiving care from the NHS tells us that the crisis in young people's mental health is a wave that's breaking now." He said, "While it was positive that more and more under-18s are receiving psychological support, the rise in the number of young people seeking help from the National Health Service is relentless and unsustainable. Over the past 2 years, young people have experienced isolation, disruption of their education, and reduced access to support, including from counsellors and GPs. All of these things have massively impacted their mental health, but these figures are only the tip of the iceberg and will continue to rise." Ollie Parker said many young people were reaching crisis point before they could get the treatment that they needed. Evidence from the Children's Commissioner for England has shown that while officials claim help from the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services is available within 6 days of being referred in certain areas, in other places families have to wait for as long as 81 days before their child is seen, despite some having self-harmed or had suicidal thoughts. A survey of general practitioners, GPs, published recently by the youth mental health charity STEM4 found that half said the child and adolescent mental health services were rejecting half of referrals they made of under-18s suffering from anxiety, depression, conduct disorder and self-harm because their symptoms were not seen as severe enough. In one case, a 12-year-old boy found with a ligature in his room was refused help because there was no marks on his neck. Nihara Kraus, a consultant clinical psychologist and founder of youth mental health charity STEM4, said that while under-18s were getting help, it was unclear from the figures how many received effective treatment. Nihara Kraus added, "Teachers and GPs say that children in mental health distress are either being rejected in record numbers because their difficulties do not meet the high threshold for treatment, or they're stuck on long waiting lists. These latest figures also lack any real detail to warrant claiming there has been a marked improvement in accessing effective treatment. They just show greater need." She said not just the prevalence, but also the severity and complexity of youth mental health problems had increased in recent years. In addition, COVID-induced loneliness, increased time spent online, disrupted routines and exposure to family stress have increased levels of distress. Catherine Roche, the chief executive of Place to Be, which provides counselling to 450 primary and secondary schools across the United Kingdom, containing 250,000 pupils, said, "What we've seen across our frontline services in the United Kingdom schools is rising numbers of young people struggling with anxiety, self-harm, eating difficulties and suicidal thoughts." A survey of school heads and other staff by Place to Be and the National Association of Head Teachers, published in February, found that large majorities had seen increases in mental health problems among school pupils since the start of the academic year, including low self-esteem, 86%, depression, 76%, and sustained feelings of anger, 68%. Catherine Roche, the chief executive of charity Place to Be, urged the National Health Service to provide many more early intervention services to support troubled young people as soon as they exhibit signs of distress before their mental health deteriorates. Claire Murdoch, NHS England's National Mental Health Director, said, "The toll of the pandemic has inevitably had an impact on the nation's mental health, with more young people than ever before accessing National Health Service services. As these figures show, demand continues to skyrocket, with a third more children treated in February this year compared to February 2020. Claire Murdoch claimed that the National Health Service had responded by expanding mental health teams in 4,700 schools and colleges and setting up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, mental health crisis telephone support services for all ages, which now receive 20,000 calls a month. The National Health Service data also shows that mental health bed shortages mean some under 16s who are sick enough to be admitted for mental health care are having to be treated on adult mental health wards, despite guidance saying that this should never happen. In February, an unspecified number of under 16s had spent 50 days on adult wards.
have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, and may God curse all their enemies. I thank you very much, honorable gentlemen, for thinking of this endeavor and taking this great step. Of course, this is just a preliminary step. This means that your action and this commemoration of Hamza, greetings be upon him, is groundwork for future endeavors. The main work must be done by art, and the performing arts, linguistic and visual arts must be used in order to achieve the purpose of honoring and commemorating a personality like Hamza. Otherwise, the mere act of organizing commemoration ceremonies will not serve the purpose just because it will be broadcast in the media and just because the name of that personality will be mentioned there for a certain period of time. The task that you want to carry out, creating a culture and presenting role models, cannot be done except with artistic work, and it will remain incomplete if artistic methods are not used. Therefore, what you are doing is very good.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As you pointed out, you must rely on precision and improve quality as much as you can. This will help those who are doing artistic work to have the necessary resources and documentations at their disposal. Now I wish to raise a few points about Hazrat Hamza. He is really one of the lesser-known companions of the Messenger of God, greetings be upon him and his household, despite the role that he played when he announced his faith. The way that he announced his faith was really astonishing as well. He publicly shouted that he had become a Muslim after having heavily beaten Abu Jahl, cited by Ibn Athir. Ibn Athir says this in Usdul Ghaba, the lions of the forest. This was his manner of faith, and as for emigration to Medina, in that glorious Islamic fortress that the Holy Prophet wanted to build in that small environment, his presence was very effective. According to one narration too, the first Sariya, that is the small army that the Holy Prophet dispatched without his own presence, that the Holy Prophet dispatched was led by Hazrat Hamza. He gave him a banner and sent him to battle. His role was also outstanding in the Battle of Badr.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.